next topic was management of metastatic disease, and to begin, I asked Dr. Dan Petrylak what he would say to a 75-year-old man with metastatic disease in terms of the downside of docetaxel-based chemotherapy, and also the upside, particularly in symptomatic patients, in terms of the chance of tumor symptoms improving with treatment.
I'll start with the symptomatic patient first, because that's a lot easier. From Donna Berry's study, we've seen from the data that was published with TAX-327 that there is a significant improvement in bone pain as well as in quality of life parameters in favor of those patients who received docetaxel who were symptomatic compared to those patients who received mitoxantrone and prednisone. So we know that the symptoms will improve.
When do they start getting better usually?
You know, I've seen it in patients almost immediately, within a week or two of starting the treatment. It's a fairly rapid response. It's not short.
Is that something that you all outside of oncology, Mike, do you see this? Your patients come back, you send them to the oncologist, and they have bone pain, they're sick, they come back feeling better after getting chemo?
Obviously, I have a limited in terms of the number of patients that are coming back after those courses of chemo, but I would say that in general, they do feel better in terms of some of the, if they had diffuse pain. Number two, they also are psychologically happier when they see that their counts are improving, their PSAs are dropping as well, and they know they're going in the right direction.
Any sort of rough guess, you know, based on your experience, based on presentations? Again, patient says to you, okay, you're saying I should go to an oncologist. What the chance is that they're going to feel better if they're symptomatic? Do you tell them it's 1 in 10, it's 50-50? You know, what kind of odds would you say to a patient? Then I'll ask the oncologist, I'll ask William what he would say.
50 to 60%.
50 to 60%. Okay, that sounds good. William, you buy into that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we wouldn't send people back to Dr. Zalewski unless it didn't work. So he probably has a very biased group of people who are coming back because they're becoming more symptomatic. But I think for symptomatic patients, at least half of the patients corresponding to response, although that's not an exact overlap, about half of the people do have, I think, a significant palliative benefit from chemotherapy. Plus, you remember that the other thing we're doing for them is we're extending their survival, and we could debate what the relative value of symptomatic benefit versus survival benefit is. But I think that those two things, as you know, Dr. Zalewski was pointing out, are important. I think psychologically they want to know that their tumors are under control. That probably improves their quality of life above and beyond, for example, pain benefit.
Are we overstating the benefits, Len, in this situation, or does that seem about right to what you see?
Again, this is a different setting, I mean, that he's talking about now. This is clearly more advanced disease where chemotherapy has got traction, it's got teeth, you've got plenty of trials that support it. My comments earlier just referred to this widespread use of chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting without really a lot of data behind it. No, I agree.
You agree with those kinds of numbers?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's not that different than what you see in colon cancer and breast cancer. Maybe a little bit better, but again, if those numbers are real, because it's one thing if it's in a paper, it's another thing if you really see it in practice. Mary Ellen, you buy into that?
Yes, and I think William's earlier comment that the disease is heterogeneous really comes into play with hormone refractory prostate cancer, that when we initially talk to a patient, we say, well, you have a 50 to 60% chance of reducing your disease burden, you know, by a significant amount and you'll feel better. But when you actually treat patients, they sort of declare themselves early on after two or three doses in terms of a group who appears to be getting no response, you stop. A group that gets an average response in which it will work for some period of time measured in months, and a group that gets a fantastic response in terms of a 2 or 3 or 4 year response to intermittent chemotherapy. So, you know, we need to figure out how to predict those groups better and how to direct treatment for them better.
I mean, certainly somebody's sick and in pain, you know, they're going to be open to a lot of options. But now let's go to the patient who really isn't symptomatic for metastatic disease. I'm actually going to start out with you, Steve. I don't know whether you ever fantasize about what you would do if you were in that situation. I think all of us tend to do that. You've got metastatic prostate cancer. You have absolutely no symptoms from it. What do you think about, from what you understand, and then we'll ask the oncologist for their kinds of numbers, in terms of delaying becoming symptomatic and extending your survival versus the kinds of side effects and quality of life issues? Do you think today, at this point in your life, you'd be interested in that? You think you'd feel differently if you were 75 and your kids are all grown?
I'm sure if I were 75 and kids were all grown, I'd feel differently. But, I mean, just knowing who I am, and I think of knowing what a lot of my patients, they don't walk in the door with non-metastatic hormone refractory disease. They made a lot of choices along the way before they got there. And it usually starts out with a choice to be screened with PSA in the first place. So they chose to be aggressive. They chose, when it was positive, to have the biopsy. They chose to undergo treatment, surgery, radiation. They chose to have the hormones before they had metastatic disease. So they, usually the patient, and I think for me it would be the same, they've chosen at every step of the game to be aggressive based upon a blood test, a PSA. So now that we have a hormone refractory rising PSA, I don't see why that mantra would be any different. I mean, the toxicities are different, but with the potential, a 20% improvement in overall survival, if you take it to the non-metastatic setting where maybe there's a 3 years rather than 16 months, a 20% delay, maybe we could buy them 7 months with chemo there. I'm not saying we can, but just statistically speaking, if it held up, would be the same. And that's approaching the year that Tom was talking about.
I guess the other way to look at it, getting back to your point, Mary Ellen, about averages, you know, actually 20% in a way sort of doesn't sound too great to me. But if I know that maybe some of these people are getting dramatic, you know, years of survival and have a chance to be in that group, that's a little bit better than, you know, maybe living an extra 6 months or a year.
Yeah, and I think this asymptomatic hormone refractory prostate cancer patient is analogous to the patient with a rising PSA in that we have some predictors. Some of these guys are just slowly rising PSA, you know, doing well, and you might hold back on chemotherapy in that patient and get intermittent scans and try to follow them along. It could be a couple of years before they develop a met, whereas other patients in that group are just, you know, their PSAs are rising rapidly. They have had other predictors prior to this point that were negative in terms of a very short response to primary hormone therapy, no response to second-line hormone therapy, and you know that patient is going to be in a not-so-good place in a short period of time, and that's a different type of patient. Again, the heterogeneity.
I'm curious, too, and William, I'm interested in your experience in this regard about what motivates people. Again, in breast cancer and somewhat in colon cancer, actually one of the things is having dependents, particularly dependent children, that will change the way people approach their decision-making. Prostate cancer, we think of older men, but there are plenty of people in their 50s with young kids, too. What do you see about how people process these kinds of difficult decisions?
I don't think there's any question that younger people who have more dependent on them financially and kind of in that point in their lives feel that they have to be as aggressive as possible. For a typical patient, let's say a guy who's in his early 70s, who's retired, asymptomatic, but has metastatic disease, whose PSA is rising, you know, you do see the influence, for example, of a spouse or the children who come with the patient. And I think people interpret it differently. There are times, and we've seen this in the hormonal therapy issue and also with the chemotherapy issue, where the patient himself may say, you know, I feel okay. Can we put this off for as long as possible? I want to keep golfing. I don't want to really inhibit my life. But you might look and see his wife saying, no, we need to really do this as much as possible, or the children. So I think, as is often the case with prostate cancers, you're not always only treating one person. And it is true. I think in the end, we recognize the survival benefit to be an issue that really has to be addressed. It's the elephant in the room when you sit across from a patient. If it was a one-year survival benefit, it would be a much shorter conversation. But I think, as Mary Ellen has pointed out, medians underestimate the value for specific patients. And I think the forest plot that I showed, which really outlined that some of our preconceptions, for example, older patients seem to have just as good a survival benefit, if not more. Statistically, you have to be careful with subset analyses. I understand that completely. But I think it's exploratory. You look at the forest plot and you say, a lot of people think older men have less survival benefit. But in fact, in TAX 327, a study of over 1,000 men, it was maybe the opposite. The same thing went for people with or without pain. So in fact, again, people without pain might have just as much, if not a little bit more, survival benefit. So in the end, symptoms are important. And there's no question that symptoms are easy, as Dan said, to justify the use of chemo. But I think the real question is, in an asymptomatic patient, if they've run out of other options, is it appropriate to wait or is it appropriate to move forward? And I think you're going to see people make that decision based on risk factors, the patient's own kind of concerns, their spouse's or their family's concerns. And in the end, I think, generally speaking, I have no problem giving an asymptomatic, metastatic patient chemotherapy. I think it's appropriate.
I see a lot more interest in this issue of the older patients. This is a big thing that came out last week at the colon think tank in terms of adjuvant chemotherapy. There was a case presented of a 92-year-old man, which everybody agreed should get FOLFOX chemotherapy, which is kind of interesting. But Dan, what about the issue of the 80-plus patient? A lot of these analyses of, quote, older patients, or most of them are, you know, less than 80. A lot of prostate cancer and oncology is 85, 90 years old.
I have some 80-year-olds who walk into my clinic who look a lot better than some 60-year-olds, even some 50-year-olds that we have. I mean, you really have to look at the patient get a sense for what their lifestyle is like, how is the chemotherapy going to influence what their overall course of the disease is. And, you know, I think it's appropriate to try sequential therapies. The problem is we don't have a good marker that's going to delineate who's the long-term responder to ketoconazole and hydrocortisone as opposed to docetaxel. And we really still don't understand what the proper sequences are.
Dan, in a minute, is going to talk about, you know, hopefully the way forward in metastatic disease and in satraplatin and new agent. But before we get to that, I want to bring up one more topic, which is end-of-life care. And what happens to these people who die? Who takes care of them? How does the urologist, medical oncologist, radiation oncologist interface? And does it happen kind of as efficiently in other tumors or not so much so? Laurie, what's your experience with that?
Well, these are patients that my colleagues and I aren't too keen to look after because of the burden of care. So I think it's a fairly widespread practice. Whatever the role of the urologist in terms of second-line hormonal therapy, and he may collaborate in managing the patient while he's on chemotherapy or occasionally give it himself, but by and large, sort of at the end, we are much happier to offload the patient onto either the medical oncologist or a palliative care service. In Canada, there's a lot of palliative care services that take on the kind of week-to-week management of these patients, do home visits. There's nursing.
What about in the United States, Anthony? My impression is the palliative care is not quite as organized as it is in Canada.
There's a growing field of palliative care medicine in this country. In fact, it's a board-certified specialty now within medical oncology, and it may become one in radiation oncology too. But in terms of the first 7 years of my career, I worked in a community outreach center, and then later I came into town. When I was in the community outreach center, I hospiced all these patients. The medical oncologists were not interested in it, believe it or not. I took care of them right to the end of life. But in the Boston arena, it's medical oncology who hospices the patient. So, I mean, I really think it depends upon...
Hospices the patient or takes care of the
patient? Well, takes care of them in conjunction with hospice. I mean, hospice is sort of where these people end up, I would say.
You know, it is a little bit of a contrast to other tumors where the oncologist, medical oncologist, is starting out much earlier in the disease. They have a much stronger relationship, so when the patient gets into that situation, there's more of a long-standing relationship. You're talking about a situation where maybe at the most difficult time, the patient gets handed off to another physician. Len, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that we're all recognizing the fact that we need better palliative care in the United States, and I think most cancer centers are now having home health care really interacting with medical oncology and the hospice formally, so we actually have more of a continuum of care of these people than we had before. I mean, urologists don't do a particularly good job of doing this. I'm impressed that Anthony was able to be a hospice doctor or take care of these end-of-life issues. But most of us, as Laurie says, in urology, rely upon our medical oncology colleagues because they really know more about this than we do. And we depend on them very heavily for that.
William?
Well, I think the real key to this question is whether or not patients should go straight from the kind of care urologists or radiation oncologists provide directly into hospice, or whether there is truly a time period where an oncologist can make an impact on the patient's quality and perhaps duration of life. And I think most of the people in this room do work with their oncology colleagues because they believe that chemotherapy and maybe other drugs that are coming down the pike really will make an impact and do make an impact for the patient's life. But we know that up to half of patients in the community, for example, never receive any chemotherapy whatsoever before they die. And so I think in some ways...
Is that true?
That has been discussed. There's never been a
good
study.
We have evidences of that in our patterns of care study, but it's not proof, and
I'm not believing it. I've heard it too, and I've never seen a good research study on this subject, but I think it wouldn't surprise me. I think there's been a bias against, this goes to the age issue, for example, a bias against prostate cancer patients being older. Perhaps it has to do with the fact that they're being referred the patient very late in the course. I can't argue with that. If I saw a guy who was, you know, wheeled in a wheelchair, and I have seen these people, it wouldn't be my enthusiasm to treat him with intravenous chemotherapy at that point. I would have liked to have seen him 6 months or a year earlier so that I might have had a chance to work with somebody who had a better performance status. It's very hard to give chemo to people with performance statuses of 3 or 4. That said, you know, I think that in most practices where there's a good relationship, that transition does occur much earlier. I mean, I know Anthony refers people to us much sooner because if you believe that there's something that a medical oncologist couldn't offer, I think that's the key.
The next topic was emerging data on the use of the oral platinum agent, satraplatin, and Dr. Dan Petrylak began the discussion.
The side effect profile is remarkably benign. You know, we've had patients on satraplatin. Our longest patient, I believe, received 14 cycles of treatment. And he did really extremely well while he was on the study.
Fatigue? Nausea?
Moderate fatigue. Really minimal nausea, moderate fatigue. As you get out longer and longer, you start seeing more hematologic toxicity. But, you know, a very well-tolerated treatment.
Any sort of global feeling about the efficacy of this agent in prostate cancer, for example, compared to docetaxel? Obviously, it's indirect comparison. Any kind of gut feeling?
I don't think you can compare them because, again, they're two different populations of patients. I mean, I think there's clear-cut clinical activity. Two most telling pieces of evidence from this presentation, the pain data. The pain data was clearly better. And the PSA data, that along with the objective response rate, those are all telling me that there is the significant activity of this drug. I think that what we're seeing here is you're seeing patient selection early on. You're seeing a population of patients, like we saw with docetaxel, that will respond for a long period of time. The trick will be in the future is selecting those patients out prior to going on a drug like satraplatin. But there are patients who I think are clearly benefiting over a long period of time with this.
You would think also with that kind of minimal toxicity issue that you might be able to combine it, for example, with docetaxel. Is that going to happen?
There are ongoing phase 1 studies. It may be a little bit difficult to get full doses of both drugs.
What's the problem?
Neutropenia.
Neutropenia. Yeah. Interesting. Here's what you all said before this meeting about what you think is going to happen, that most of you think that satraplatin is going to be approved for prostate cancer, I guess, based on these data. Not everybody's convinced of that, but it seems like a trend. And I guess at a more clinical level, we look at the next survey question in terms of how useful or not useful it might be. We made the statement, for patients refractory to hormones who develop progressive disease on a first-line docetaxel regimen, satraplatin prednisone represents a clinically meaningful option with the potential to improve quality of life and or survival. Dan, most people agree with that. I take it you agree with that.
I agree with that.
So if it were available today, exactly how would you use it?
Exactly as what we did with this trial, use it in patients who failed prior docetaxel.
Are there efforts to look at this agent in other tumors?
There are studies ongoing in lung cancer. There is a renal study that was done at Memorial. There is a bladder study, I believe, that's going on. There are a number of different studies that are going to look at it.
Interesting. Any questions, comments?
A couple of questions. One, there's a tremendous drop-off.
Right.
Is that what typically happens with these refractory
drop-off?
In other words,
yep.
Progression and death. I mean, the first 10 weeks on everything, there's just almost a steep decline down the low levels. Is this something you typically see with a second-line salvage protocol?
Well, we've seen this with some of the monoclonal antibodies. There's a publication, New England Journal of Medicine, with Vectivix, which is the EGFR antagonist that's being used for colorectal cancer. You could superimpose those curves with Vectivix.
So this speaks to how sick these people are and how quick they're going down.
It reflects that. The other thing is, too, this was independent response review committee adjudicated measurement that included pain. So somebody flared up in their pain scales at the beginning of treatment. We've seen flares with certain drugs. They had to come off. So that's why you see this discrepancy.
William?
It's actually in the prior docetaxel-treated patients, I believe the difference in progression-free survival at the median was 1 week.
1 week.
So you might ask, what's the point? That's one interpretation. And I think it's really important because it really gets to what you just pointed out, Dr. Gamella, which is that there is a subset. This has been a theme of our conversation where you have to go beyond the median to see the splaying of the two curves. This makes a lot of sense to us because I think that there's a platinum-sensitive subset. There is other data with other platinum drugs that clearly show that some patients really respond quite well to platinum-based agents. And I think this was a very large randomized trial that, in fact, demonstrates that exact fact. The problem is if you look at the median, you lose what might be a very dramatic benefit in maybe about a third of the patients because at the median, most people won't have benefited from this drug very much.
Before we go to Steve, I want to ask you the same question we asked about docetaxel before. So you have a patient who's progressed on hormones, they've progressed on docetaxel, and they're symptomatic. They say to you, what's the chance I'm going to feel better if I take satraplatin?
Well, there's a clear-cut pain difference. I mean, if you look at the pain data, 25% versus 12% overall, and the absolute difference is in the pain scale. So there's a fairly good chance these patients will feel better with
the drug. Have you seen patients yourself who had dramatic pain responses?
Absolutely. Yes.
Steve?
Certainly a delay in progression, reduction in pain is a clinically meaningful endpoint. My question is, how good is time to progression in hormone refractory prostate cancer
question.
As an endpoint? We've now seen several trials. You mentioned the DN-101. We saw the Provenge. Both showed, and we saw this with atrasentan as well, no delay in time to progression. Benefit, but was not statistically significant, but significant survival benefits. You look at Howard Scherer had a publication saying progression is not a good surrogate endpoint. I think, Dan, your article in JNCI also said progression is not a good surrogate for survival. Can we be using progression as an endpoint, or does survival need to remain the primary endpoint for these trials?
Again, it depends upon what portion of the pie you're looking at. I think that earlier on, when a patient may be progressing slowly, that may be less of an important issue, particularly in asymptomatic patients. As you go further and further down the course of hormone refractory disease, when it's more of an accelerated course, I think progression is more significant. If you're delaying the time that somebody's going to develop bone pain, these patients will live on an average of about 10 to 12 months overall. So I think that there, that's a different issue. It's almost like what's been said in a lot of these clinical outcome design studies. You know, it depends upon your drug, what your overall state of the disease is. There are a lot of different factors. And I think you probably can start thinking about subdividing hormone refractory disease.
Not that it's the only consideration, but just kind of curious. What about the fact that it's the oral agent? How much of an advantage in these kinds of patients is that?
I think it's an advantage. You know, you run into an issue of compliance with this as well, and you don't know what people are getting at a given point, but I think it's an advantage. You know, every 5 weeks is certainly an advantage rather than coming in every 3 weeks. So those are both advantages for the patient.
Anthony?
If I remember correctly, Cora said that 56% of the patients, Dan, had prior Taxotere, and you show the plots that there was an improvement of all the endpoints that you described in that previously treated group. So there's a question and then a comment. The question is, I realize that it will have been two cycles of chemo or two different chemos before we get to the next question, which is, did people who got satraplatin who weren't previously treated with Taxotere respond to Taxotere subsequently? That's the question. And the comment is, it just seems to me that if you can get a response and people have already had the standard of care, Taxotere, and half the patients in the study, it just seems to me, I'm not a medical oncologist, that maybe the satraplatin is preferred. And so the question I'm asking is really, the guys who got satraplatin who never got Taxotere, did they respond to Taxotere afterwards? Do we know that? Because if they did, then I guess you could flip it both ways.
The data is very, I've seen it, it's not very consistently put together. But what I will say is, in looking at a lot of these second-line studies that are coming out, what I think the pattern is those patients who respond to the second-line treatment are the ones who responded to the first-line treatment. We haven't looked at this in this database yet. You know, that old adage, responders do better. It's selecting out for a different biological group. Now, I think that the problem with this database is that they did not capture the initial response to docetaxel or to mitoxantrone or whatever else. The way I think we're going to capture that is by the length or the duration of their primary treatment, because they'll be on the treatment longer if they're responding.
I guess implicit in your question, too, is the thought that quality of life might be better on satraplatin and docetaxel. Is that the reality, Dan?
You know, it's so hard to compare both groups. I don't think that you really can make that comparison.
Laurie?
Just an information question. Is the requirement for creatinine clearance more or less the same as with cisplatinum?
No. No, it's actually
not as nephrotoxic.
Not as nephrotoxic.
And did you see nephrotoxicity in
no.
the... No.
None.
So, Laurie, does it sound like something your patients might be interested in?
Well, it sounds great because, first of all, it looks like it's got activity. And sitting here as a urologist, you know, we tend to have a preference for oral non-toxic agents. So, you know, it's going to be a real, rightly or wrongly, it's going to be attractive to urologic oncologists as an agent that they may be interested in giving.
I mean, it's a palliative situation. It's rightly when it's less toxic. I mean, all the struggling we've been talking about whether to give chemotherapy is based on the fact that it's not, you know, a non-toxic agent. You have a non-toxic agent, these discussions get a lot easier. I'll take 2 weeks progression-free survival if it's non-toxic. William?
I think it might open the door to patients and also physicians who might otherwise feel that their patients are not a candidate for chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And it may therefore open the door to using Taxotere subsequently. And to answer Anthony's question, at least biologically, there's no reason to believe that they should be cross-reactive in terms of sensitivity. So now that said, again, we don't know because it hasn't been looked at in the first-line setting. This is clearly a second-line study. I think what I'm interested in is really, you know, looking at urologists and radiation oncologists and getting their thoughts, because I'm impressed with how convinced they are that this is clinically meaningful. I think for oncologists, we believe this, but does anyone have any concerns or doubts about whether or not this is clinically meaningful to this group of patients? You know, getting to the issue of median, getting to the issue that Steve brought up, is progression-free survival relevant?
I think it's coming out of the fact that it's not toxic. I mean, it's a lot easier to accept. You know, and also the issue about the relationship between the oncologist and the patient. We hear the story all the time, for example, in breast cancer, that the patient said, I don't want to receive chemotherapy. I'd rather die than get chemotherapy. We actually documented in our survey of colon cancer patients that what they expected, in spite of all the education they got, was completely different than what they experienced, because they're hearing things about chemotherapy. And we hear a lot of stories about those patients going to the oncologist and getting capecitabine, an oral chemotherapeutic agent, because they're, you know, it sounds not so bad. Then they get a response, and then they go, okay, what else do you have? So maybe that would be, you know, an avenue to increase, you know, sort of the referral pattern to oncologists.
I think there'll be a move to try and do this as a first-line treatment. When you take a look at it and you see the toxicity, you see the ease at which it was given, the natural thing is, and I can imagine some urologists would be very interested in actually taking a look at this themselves. You had no significant febrile neutropenia, and it wasn't that difficult to give, and it's certainly an avenue by which chemo can be introduced, and perhaps even introduced up front as, this isn't real chemo, this is an oral agent. This is, you know, that's,
chemo light.
It's, well, that's kind of how it could certainly be played like that, and I hope they're planning to perhaps do a study where they look at it as a first-line treatment.
Is that happening, Dan?
I know there are studies looking at combination. I don't know of any study at this point looking at a single agent front.
What are we trying to do
why,
though? Squad.
Why?
Excuse me?
Thought we were...
Second line.
We were talking about front line, too.
We were talking about front line, but second
why
line.
Why has no one even done it in the pilot study yet?
Well, there was a small pilot study done, front line.
What
that was that was Cora's study.
No, her first one was front line.
That was front line.
Oh, her small study was a front line study.
That was a front line study.
And that's what led to it, and that did show activity.
Right, it did show activity. It was way, way, way underpowered, but still it showed a progression-free survival benefit.
What do you think about this idea of using it first line in the absence of data, Dan?
Well, I mean, I'm uncomfortable with it from the standpoint that that's not what the trial data shows us. Conversely, we don't have, again, we're looking at second hormone therapies when we're looking at other treatments. We don't have any good sequencing data. But the data right now is based upon Taxotere first and then Satraplatin second.